During World War II, as Allied intelligence scrambled for information about Axis plans and movements in Greece, the Office of Strategic Services enlisted the aid of an unlikely group of people, archaeologists. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air, and we'll hear the stories of some of those remarkable archaeologists from Susan Hoyk Allen, visiting scholar in classics at Brown University, and also the author of Classical Spies, American Archaeologists with the OSS in World War II Greece, published by the University of Michigan Press in 2011. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
A fairly specialized topic, but you have an archaeological background for starters. How big a part did that play in your interest in this topic?
Well, it was a huge part. I first became aware of archaeology through my granddad, who visited Egypt and Pompeii when I was in fourth grade. My dad was interested in Native American things, and I had a professor at Smith College who taught all about Greece. So I was predestined to be interested in archaeology and Greece. And my granddad's next-door neighbor was an archaeologist who dug at Troy in the 1930s.
Well, so you definitely had it in your background.
Exactly.
And but why this aspect of Greece in particular, though, World War II and this whole phenomenon of archaeologists doing something that's not really archaeology, is it?
So that person who lived next to my granddad, Jack Caskey, he invited me to come to Greece to work with him when I was a graduate student at the University of Cincinnati. And we were on a Greek island. And one night at ouzo hour, you can imagine, the sun is setting. It's gorgeous. It's this beautiful Greek yachting harbor. And we're all tossing back ouzos. And Mr. Caskey had a little bit too many. And he started talking. He asked us if we'd ever heard of an individual by the name of Cicero. Well, I was a classics graduate
Roman
student.
Orator.
Exactly. I thought he meant the Roman orator. And he said no. He meant an Albanian Turk whose code name was Cicero. And he had infiltrated the British embassy in Ankara, Turkey, during World War II, and he became the valet to the British ambassador. Now, this British ambassador was not very careful with his security, and when he was out at embassy parties, Cicero would enter his private study. He'd already made a copy of the key to the ambassador's safe, and he would open it and take out top-secret documents, photograph them with his Leica, and sell the film to the Germans. Now, these documents involved things like Operation Overlord, the code name for D-Day.
Yeah.
And they went as far as Hitler's desk. And because this particular Turkish spy was so eloquent with the information that he produced for the Germans, the German ambassador nicknamed him Cicero.
And I have to at least digress far enough to pursue the trail of Cicero in this. If he had the secret to Operation Overlord, D-Day, before the invasion, and you say it got to Hitler, why didn't Hitler act on it? How credible was Cicero?
Good question. So, like many bureaucracies, the intelligence bureaucracy that was available to Hitler was made up of several camps, and they didn't trust each other. And so one camp believed in this documentation from the British ambassador, and the other one didn't. So they couldn't decide what to make of it.
Wow. So a classic bureaucratic malfunction.
Exactly.
At the highest levels of German intelligence.
Exactly. So the story did not stop there. So Mr. Caskey, who was in his 70s at this point, an elderly gentleman to a young woman who was in her 20s, Mr. Caskey proceeded to tell us how this was made into a film, and the film was starring James Mason as Cicero.
Oh, as Cicero.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. I've seen it. It's good.
Uh-huh.
And there was a young German woman. She actually grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. Her dad was the German consul there. And she was acting as a double agent. She was working as a temp secretary in the German embassy in Ankara. And she figured out who Cicero was. He would call periodically. She would pick up the phone. And then she saw him around town. And she identified him. She figured out who he was. And then she went to the British for asylum. She wanted to defect. She went to the British for asylum, but because she was a German citizen, they wouldn't touch her with a 10-foot pole. So then they came to the Americans. And this is where my professor came in. And he said that he was part of the story. He wasn't in the movie, but he was uh-huh. part of the story because he was asked to get this woman who was wanted dead or alive by the Germans at this point. His job was to get her out of Turkey.
Well, that's certainly the stuff of movies, isn't it?
Well, I'm not done. So Mr. Kasky was quite a ladies' man. In his 70s, he was no different. And when he described this woman, his eyes were like the size of saucers. So we all knew she was a babe. And we were just sitting at the edges of our seats. And he told us how he had to get her out of Turkey by moonlight by kayiki, which is a Greek or Turkish fishing vessel.
Yeah, I think that was a common way of sneaking people out of the country. I mean, the whole Norwegian treasury left the country that way during World War II.
Exactly.
And how did that work?
So, it was successful. It was successful.
And so he got her to the States, ultimately?
Well, he had to protect her first. He stood outside her door all night long until it was time to go by car to the secret harbor from which she was embarked on one of these kayikis that went to Cyprus and then to Cairo, Alexandria and Cairo.
This professor of yours, he was an archaeologist.
He was.
And the premise of your book is that the OSS, the forerunner, I guess, of the CIA during World War II, actually recruited archaeologists in that part of the world, Greece in particular, to do espionage work.
Exactly so.
Why archaeologists?
Well, so to go back to the First World War— In the First World War, archaeologists were used by the Germans and the British, particularly in Greece. So John Linton Myers, an Oxford Don, was known as the Blackbeard of the Aegean because he was a special operations agent in charge of raiding the Turkish coastline and then retreating to Greece. Then you had Lawrence of Arabia, who was, in fact, an archaeologist working with his boss, Leonard Woolley, on an excavation in Syria. They were both in intelligence work during World War I. You had Gertrude Bell doing intelligence work while she was head of the Department of Antiquities in Mesopotamia. Many archaeologists. And for those who are interested in archaeologist spies, the British one who was everyone's favorite was John Pendlebury, who had dug at Knossos and Tell el Amarna in Egypt. And when the war came, he was recruited to be the person who drummed up and organized Cretan resistance because he'd excavated on Crete. And
which was fierce, that resistance, when the time came.
It was fierce. And during the Battle of Crete, he was caught by the Germans, identified by his glass eye, and shot. So all of these people were British.
And
the Americans were late to get involved with archaeology and espionage. But they thought it would be a perfect combination of qualities. When they were recruiting, when the OSS was recruiting, it's interesting that they were looking for humanists.
It is, yes, because this is espionage, but they want humanists.
They wanted humanists. They wanted people who knew languages and had geographical expertise. They wanted people who could work together, archaeology, and they wanted people who could be self-starters.
And these people,
so the archaeologists were natural.
And these people, these archaeologists, presumably would also have connections in the countries where they've been working.
Exactly. So my professor, Jack Caskey, had been working at Troy. He'd been excavating at Troy in the 1930s as a graduate student. And he and his best friend, also working at Troy as a graduate student, were both recruited. And the director of excavations at Troy, Carl Blagan, was also recruited. The archaeologist who was in charge of being the architect at the Troy excavations was a woman, Dorothy Cox, from Bryn Mawr. And she got a master's degree at Columbia in architecture. She was recruited. And I just have to say, I find Dorothy Cox a fascinating figure. Not only was she an architect, she was a numismatist, who studies ancient coins. She had terrible handwriting, but she was a really good draftsperson. Anyway, Dorothy Cox was recruited at age 50. She was a single woman. She was thrilled. She became our chief interrogator. Absolutely fearless woman. When she was stationed in Izmir, Turkey, her cover was Greek War Relief, and she would find refugees who were coming from Greece into Turkey. She would invite them back to her flat, refugees or Kaiki captains. It didn't matter. She was trying to get intelligence. She first tried giving them tea, but then she found rakı, which is the Turkish equivalent of ouzo, worked much better. Anyway, our ambassador called her our best man in Turkey.
So I'm curious, you mentioned that her cover was Greek relief, but if you have an archaeologist at Columbia or some university in the United States, for example, and it's 1944, and suddenly this person has to go away on the secret assignment for the OSS, what explanation did they give?
Oh, let's see. Gerald Els, a Harvard PhD who was hired by the University of Iowa, had to talk to his dean and say that he was required for a government job. He couldn't say what it was, but it was a government job. And he didn't know when he would be back. So there were many different explanations, many different motivations. These were all basically assistant professors. They'd just been hired, most of them around 1939, got their first academic job. They were assistant professors. And my professor, Mr. Caskey, thought it was great because it was a big pay raise. Plus, it smacked of intrigue.
But danger.
Well, everyone had different motivations. Some of them were patriotic. Some of them were thrilled to be asked to do a job that they were uniquely fitted to do, particularly the women were thrilled to be asked to do that kind of work. So when they were recruited, when they were accepted, they went to the farm, which was in horse country outside Washington. And they went in groups of two, and they were totally anonymous. They were given code names, and they were kept up all night. First of all, they had classes all day. They were kept up all night at parties, and they tried to break their cover.
Well, I was going to say, when you say code names, were they known to each other, though? That would seem inevitable in some cases.
They were known to each other.
But I see. But they were assigned these code names to use when they were overseas, and then they were tested.
Well, these were just false names. At the farm, they were just false names. And they were tested to see if they would break their cover. They went through a psychological battery, all kinds of things. They learned to shoot handguns. They engaged in combat, all kinds of things. They were left at X location, and they had to find their way back to the farm using any means possible. They learned how to write in invisible ink. They learned how to handle homing pigeons.
Really?
They actually thought they were going to use them, but they didn't. So there was an element of danger. And the psychiatrist who was reviewing my professor, who was interrogating him, was worried about him being unusually fearful of what he would do if he were caught.
Sounds reasonable, but unusually fearful.
Unusually fearful. Another one, his best friend, Jerry Sperling, who comes from Wisconsin, from Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Jerry Sperling, they were worried about because he loved to spook. And they thought his excessive carefulness would give him away. And I have a great story, which I just have to tell you. I do oral history all over the place, and I was at an event at the Greek embassy in 2007 where they were really belatedly honoring Greek American veterans of the OSS. And I met a wonderful man there from Gary, Indiana, Spiro Kaponis. And Spiro told me it was really great because all of his friends in OSS were dead and I knew them all through my research. So we had all these friends in common. Anyway, Spiro was telling me about when he was a very young man and he was a Navy radio operator working for the OSS. And he was going with his chums to Istanbul and he got to Haydarpasa train station. And there was his contact. It was Jerry Sperling. And he was wearing a slouch hat, a trench coat, and he was extending his arm. And on his knuckle was a ruby ring.
That was the sign.
I'm just saying it was rather obvious.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So Spiro used to tap out his coded messages from Greek Thrace, which is right cheek by jowl with Turkey, overland connection. He was embedded with the Greek guerrillas in Greek Thrace, and he had to tap out his coded messages to Cairo using his Gary, Indiana high school fight song as a cipher.
Well, anything that would work. Now, you've given us some idea, Susan, of the qualifications for these archaeologists recruited to be spies by the OSS, but what personality traits were they selected for? Because there are a lot of archaeologists in the United States. How did the OSS choose in terms of personality profile?
Okay. I'll go to Dorothy Cox. Dorothy Cox was one of very few women who were not clerks with the OSS. Very few women who actually got out of the office. And she was recruited and sent to the farm. And for her psychological testing, they said she was as good or better than all of the male recruits and that they paid attention to her. They followed her orders. And she was completely nondescript. She didn't call attention to herself. So those were things that they really valued in Dorothy Cox.
So, again, this is what, 1944 by the time the American archaeologists get involved?
They were recruited in 1942. The earliest get involved right after Pearl Harbor in December of 1941. That was Benjamin Merritt, who was at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, which was a place where a lot of the recruiting took place. It was not at Princeton University, but very close by. And that was an interesting branch of the OSS. It was directed by a gentleman by the name of Poole, who taught at the School for Public and International Service at Princeton. And he was charged by Wild Bill Donovan, the head of OSS, to found the Foreign Nationalities Branch. The Foreign Nationalities Branch was engaged in domestic surveillance.
We don't hear too much about that, do we?
Domestic surveillance of foreign-speaking minorities in the United States. And they were engaged in following press, following radio broadcasts, in order to glean intelligence to guide U.S. foreign policy and also to find out about resistance movements in these various countries. And Benjamin Merritt became in charge of the Greek intelligence for the Foreign Nationalities Branch. And he turned his office. He was an epigrapher. He studied ancient Greek inscriptions. And he turned his office at the Institute for Advanced Study into a think tank for modern Greece. And he recruited archaeologists. He recruited the archaeologists he knew from his dig in the ancient Athenian marketplace. A lot of women, not just men. And it's interesting that these volunteer readers were located all over the country. So you could participate in the OSS and be a housewife if you had the proper training. You could be in Evanston. You didn't have to be in Washington or Princeton.
You could be one of these monitors, for example. Mm-hmm. We're going to follow the fortunes, the adventures of some of these archaeologist spies when they actually get on the ground in Greece when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Susan Hoik Allen, visiting scholar in classics at Brown University and author of the book Classical Spies, American Archaeologists with the OSS in World War II Greece. And we've looked at some of the qualifications, you might say, for being drafted as a spy for the OSS, an archaeologist spy in particular. And now we're going to go specifically to Greece, where many of these operatives worked during the war. And what kind of place was Greece during World War II? We think of it as being slightly at the periphery, but I gather that wasn't really the case.
Well, for a long time, Greece hesitated to get involved in the war. Mussolini was to the west of Greece. And in 1939, on Good Friday, he invaded Albania just to the northwest. Albania absolutely on Greece's border. So this was very threatening for the Greeks. And Mussolini had every intention of continuing east into Greece. And the Greeks were very nervous about this. And in 1940, there were a number of provocations where Mussolini was sort of testing the water, but the Greeks didn't bite. And then finally, on October 28, 1940, Mussolini's ambassador to Greece woke the Greek prime minister in the middle of the night with an ultimatum demanding that Greece allow him and his troops to occupy unspecified places throughout Greece. And the Greek dictator, Greece was under a fascist dictator at this time, General Yanis Metaxas, famously shouted, "Ohi." And since then, it's been known as Ohi Day, October 28th.
A gesture of defiance.
Exactly. And within hours, Mussolini's troops had invaded across the border. And the Greeks sent their troops to meet the Italians on the traditional avenues of invasion. But Mussolini's crack troops went over mountains which the Greeks had thought impassable. They had one regiment that was there, and they were told to fight to the death. And against all odds, they managed to hold back the Italians.
It starts to sound like the, Thermopylae and
yes,
that kind of thing.
They held back the Italians. It was, women and old men. It was too steep for mules. Women and old men were supplying this regiment to help them hold it. And within 2 weeks, November 22nd, 1940, 3 weeks, the Greeks had pushed the Italians back into Albania and scored the first land victory of the Allies in Europe of the Second World War. November 22, 1940. So imagine Greece is headlining the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Fort Wayne Daily Sentinel. December cover photograph on Life magazine is of a Greek freedom fighter.
Right.
Huge impact everywhere, psychologically, that little Greece has scored this major victory. Well, you can imagine that this did not please Hitler. He didn't want Mussolini to get involved there in the first place, and Mussolini had botched it. So Hitler then had plans of an invasion of his own. And this came during the first week of April 1941. And unlike Mussolini, Hitler's troops marched pretty much straight to Athens. Most of the Greek soldiers were fighting in Albania, so there were very few people left to protect Greece. And there were a few British there. Churchill had promised Greece aid, but provided too little too late, and it was completely ineffective.
So Greece becomes a German-occupied country.
Greece becomes a German-occupied country. The fall of Crete happened at the end of May, beginning of June, and immediately after the fall of Crete, the Germans begin siphoning off all food products, every single vehicle, every single bit of technology for the Russian front, because their next conquest, they think, is going to be the Soviet Union.
Which they certainly start in 1941.
So what happens in Greece is that famine breaks out. There is no food. They didn't have they took the seed crop. They took everything. And so famine breaks out. And one American woman who was told to leave but didn't writes home that 2-year-old children weigh the weight of a 5-month-old baby.
So it's a country in desperate straits. It's under occupation by the Germans, and then somehow the OSS figures that they can get foreign, meaning American in particular, spies into Greece and somehow get them to blend in. How did that go about?
So backtrack just a little bit. We were talking about cover in the first segment of the program. The American archaeologists were always planning on using archaeology as their cover. And then they found out that it had been used so frequently in the First World War that it was tantamount to putting yourself in front of a firing squad if you got caught. So they had to scramble before they went to the Mediterranean to find other cover. My professor, Jack Caskey, was a commercial attaché in Izmir, Turkey. So he had to find out about things like leech farming, which is big around Izmir, or was at the time. And his friend Jerry Sperling in Istanbul was a military attaché. Other people had other covers, so they really had to scramble. And they did not go into Greece right away. They used
Greek refugees fleeing Greece across the Mediterranean to Alexandria and Cairo. These people were recruited and sent back in. People from the Greek army who had managed to get out of Greece went back in as American agents. Also, Greek Americans were used as agents. And in fact, in general, the OSS preferred Greek Americans because they didn't have political biases. In Greece at this time, there was a right-wing guerrilla group and there was a left-wing guerrilla group. The left wing was far more effective than the right wing, and people felt very passionately on one side or the other. And so by having Greek American recruits,
they weren't involved in that fight.
Less likelihood of being involved in that.
And that that actual polarizing of left versus right did turn into a civil war in Greece by 1944. So it was a considerable rift there on top of this or underneath this German occupation.
A considerable rift. And it was a problem from the beginning when FDR and Churchill signed the Atlantic Charter in August of 1941. One of the principal points was self-determination. And this was a problem because Churchill wanted to return the king to Greece, and the Greek people did not want the king. The king had evacuated the country and left them to the mercy of the Nazis. They did not want him back. And what they wanted was they wanted to be able to have a referendum to be able to choose who would be the head of their country. And yet Churchill basically crammed the king down their throats.
Well, that was part of a pattern, wasn't it, that we see, you know, in places like Iraq and Iran, too, later, a little bit later. So the archaeologists then, these American archaeologists, the non-Greek American archaeologists, are they like airdropped into Greece?
So they were stationed all around Greece. They were in Izmir, Turkey, which is directly opposite Athens across the Aegean Sea. They were in Istanbul. The Istanbul location was for sending agents overland into Greek Thrace. The Izmir location was to use, they were moving agents by sea, by kaikis, these Greek or Turkish fishing vessels, into specific areas of Greece. And there were agents in there were archaeologists in Cyprus, and once Bari was taken in Italy, there were also American archaeologists there. But the thinking was that because the American archaeologists had planned the entire network, that they were way too valuable
to put in the field,
to put in the field where they could be captured and made to talk. They were still in danger where they were, because although Turkey was a neutral country, it wasn't so neutral. I mean, one of the OSS operations was to blow up a railroad bridge in occupied Greek Thrace. The reason why this was so critical, and I just have to say, these bridges all had names like Milwaukee, Joliet, Chicago. Can't remember the other ones. Those were all the code names. So the reason why this railroad bridge was so important was because the Germans were bringing Turkish chrome back to Germany to use to harden their steel for the German war machine.
So the Turks, in other words, were trading war material with the Germans.
I'm just saying it wasn't so neutral.
Right. Well, let's get into some case studies, if we may, you know, some specific individual archaeologist spies and how they fared in this cauldron of World War II Greece. You know, you mentioned one, Susan, from Wisconsin. Were there others from Wisconsin?
So I already mention Jerry Sperling, who was from Sheboygan, Wisconsin. This was the archaeologists were largely recruited as part of an old boy network. The women went to Bryn Mawr or Smith or Radcliffe. The men went to Harvard, Princeton, Yale, pretty much. And so at Harvard, you had Sterling Dow, professor of classics, recruiting his PhD students. One of them, Jerry Else, a philologist and philosopher, was one of the last Harvard PhDs to write his dissertation, brace yourself, completely in Latin.
I didn't realize there was a trend that continued that late.
It was still happening in the 30s. Now, one of Jerry Else's colleagues was a guy named Charles Farwell Edson. Edson was an historian at Harvard, and he had graduated, he'd gone to Stanford, graduated 29, graduated with his PhD from Harvard in 1939. He had attended the American School of Classical Studies in Athens, and while he was there in the summers, 1935-38, he walked the length and breadth of Macedonia, the province where Thessaloniki is, looking for ancient Greek inscriptions. He was an epigrapher, just like Benjamin Merritt was at Princeton and Dow at Harvard. So Charles Edson came to Wisconsin in 1938. And when the war started, he was drafted. His draft rating was 1B. That's bad news. All of the other archaeologists were married. Edson was not married. He could be drafted at any time. It was 21 to 36. You were fair game to be drafted. He was 35. So he said he would serve anywhere, and Benjamin Merritt recommended him for the OSS. And my main character, Rodney Young, a Princeton man, said, well, Edson was very Harvard. But he still forwarded his name to the main recruitment guy. And he was accepted for the OSS. But you know bureaucracy, it takes forever. And he was going through security clearance when the Army got him. And they drafted him as a private in the infantry. This is a guy, incredibly erudite, who had just been awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship. And then he gets drafted to be an infantry private, and they send him off to boot camp.
Well, we've seen, you know, that the Germans had this problem with their bureaucracy and bungling the information about Operation Overlord, the Normandy invasion plan. And now we see an example of bureaucratic bungling on the Allied side.
Well, all of these, you know, the Army was jealous. They didn't want the OSS involved in collecting intelligence. Before that, it had been all State Department and military forces with intelligence. And what was this upstart civilian thing doing anyway? So there was a great deal of sort of jealousy between the different groups of intelligence organizations. And William Langer, a Harvard historian, who was in charge of the OSS research and analysis branch, spent 6 months trying to get Edson out of boot camp. And he finally succeeded. And that's how Edson got to the OSS. He was a reports officer first in Washington, and then he was sent to Cairo. He was sent to Cairo in October of 1943. And from March 43 onward, one of the things that he was reporting on was deportations of Jews from Greek cities. Now, he reported the deportation of over 50,000 Jews from Thessaloniki in the summer of 1943. And then he reported about deportations of Jews from Athens. And then he reported a year after the first ones, the deportation of Jews from the city of Yanina in central Greece. And it was only over a year after his first reports that the State Department started paying attention.
So their work was not always appreciated, not always used.
That's a good point because in 1940 and 42, when the OSS was getting underway, everyone remembered Greece's heroic stance against Mussolini. And Greece was foremost in everyone's minds. But as the United States entered the war, they had their hands full. And so material wasn't always paid attention to. I could say more.
Well, yes, a lot of data coming in and a lot of urgency to a lot of that data and difficult times, to say the least. We're going to be looking at some more of these archaeologist spies in Greece during World War II, and we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Susan Hoik Allen, visiting scholar in classics at Brown University and the author of Classical Spies, American Archaeologists with the OSS in World War II Greece. And we've heard about Charles Edson, who, as it turns out, was a professor of ancient history at the UW-Madison, who was one of these archaeologists' recruits in World War II. What role, then, did he play, and was it fully revealed at the time or not?
So we talked about Edson being drafted as an infantry private. He got promoted to sergeant when he was in Washington working with Sterling Dow, and then he got sent to Cairo and became a captain. So he's working his way up in the world. When he was in Cairo, he was in charge of recruits and training. So he was the one who was getting these Greek refugees who were streaming into Egypt as they were able.
Now, this was British-controlled territory, Egypt.
Yes. So they were streaming into Egypt, and they wanted to go back into their homeland and fight. And so Edson was looking at this pack of refugees and trying to discern which ones would be good, which ones had what it took to be an agent, which ones might be suffering from anxiety or chronic fatigue. And so originally the OSS had a training camp on the shores of the Mediterranean, but that was rather far from Cairo and difficult to control. And so they moved it up to a villa outside Cairo, which was very easy to control, but hard for security. At any rate, that's where Edson worked. And he slept there. He slept with, you know, these Greek recruits, and he trained them. And he trained them in mapping, in handling close combat, firearms, all these things. And then he was passing them on for missions all over Greece, at least 27 different missions. And eventually, Edson himself went into Greece.
I thought he would be too valuable for that.
He was too valuable for that. However, Greece was liberated in mid-October of 1944. Immediately, all of the archaeologists took up their places around the country of Greece. The person who was head of the Greek desk at this point, an archaeologist by the name of Rodney Young, who had been involved in Albania and was in charge of the hub at Cairo. Rodney Young was first to go in.
He went in mid-October. Edson came with the second wave on November 2, 1944. At that point, he was supposed to go into Macedonia, but the first priority was to discharge the different groups of agents and give them their papers, their pay, etc. That's what he was doing in Athens when civil war broke out on December 3rd, 1944. He was in Athens. He was a reports officer for the Greek desk of OSS when civil war broke out. When civil war broke out in the streets of Athens, many of you may have been to Syntagma Square, seen the Greek Parliament building, the Grand Bretagne Hotel. My professor was stationed at the Grand Bretagne Hotel. There was going to be a big demonstration. It became bloody when the police began to shoot the leftist resistance fighters who had come to peaceably demonstrate against Churchill wanting to return the king to Greece. The leftists were not having any of that. And the police fired on the crowd, shooting women and children, and civil war broke out. The OSS at this point was established at the Greek Archaeological Institute. They had taken it over. You can imagine the beds were still warm when the, you know, Germans fled and the OSS took it over. That was their headquarters. And they are very near the leftist stronghold in Athens. As they're filing these reports, one woman, Missy Crosby, who worked as an archaeologist at the excavations in the ancient Athenian marketplace, she is also a reports officer. She's writing reports to Cairo saying, "Look, I'm sorry about my typos, but there are bullets flying over my head." And it was very, very dangerous. The only American citizens with the OSS who died during the Second World War died in the month of December 1944. I have said about Churchill wanting to return the king. American policy and British policy were not the same for Greece. The Americans had a hands-off policy. They wanted the Greeks to be able to have self-determination. But the British were all about returning the king.
Well, that's that colonial legacy.
Exactly. The British resented the Americans being in Greece. They thought Greece was their, you know,
their sphere.
Exactly. They resented the American presence. They didn't necessarily treat the OSS as allies. And on Christmas Eve 1944, two Americans with the OSS were inviting people to a party, and they were shot by the British.
Shot by the British?
Yes. One died.
How did that happen?
They were at a checkpoint, and people didn't ask questions. They just shot. Churchill, at this point, told his general to treat Athens as a conquered country. British planes were strafing the streets of Athens. British tanks were all over the streets of Athens.
For the sake of returning the king. I mean,
yes,
the Germans were
yes.
gone.
Exactly.
This is for the sake of returning the Greek king.
The Germans left in October.
Did that create any kind of problem with the American-British relations, or was it something in the scheme of war that just had to be pretty much swept under the carpet?
It was very touchy. This became known in the United States, the British policy in Athens. They had tried to keep it tamped down, tried to censor the press. It didn't happen because OSS was reporting back, and OSS had a system of rating. A was absolutely critical intelligence. And whereas the United States perhaps did not pay such great attention to the intelligence coming back from Greece earlier in the war when things blew up in Athens in December 1944. This was critical intelligence, and it was debated on the Senate floor what to do. It went to the highest level in the OSS and with the American government. And you have to imagine, December 1944, this is when the Battle of the Bulge is occurring. This is not the only, you know, critical...
There are other things going on.
Exactly. Huge things going on. The Battle of the Herchon Forest. And this is just after December 1944 is when Charles Edson takes over the Greek desk in Athens, takes over the Athens station. His colleague, Jerry Else, who wrote his dissertation at Harvard on ancient Greek tragedy, in charge of the Athens station in December 1944, witnesses a modern Greek tragedy, is dressed down for what happened, the shooting of the American OSS officer, is replaced by Charles Edson. And Charles Edson has a very difficult role to play.
Well, very difficult he's role got, to play. He's got the civil war between the leftists and the rightists, and then he's got this situation between the British and the Americans in Greece.
It got so bad that on Christmas Day, Churchill flew to Greece. He appeared in Greece to try and broker some kind of an agreement.
Successfully? How did it play out in the career of Charles Edson?
Well, Charles Edson wasn't in control at that point yet. So he came in after it had already happened. And how you feel about it depends on your politics.
What did become of Greece? It didn't become communist, but it didn't become a kingdom either again, did it?
So the king came back, and there was a phony referendum. Archaeologists were involved. I have to say I'm very skeptical of the title cultural attaché. As a result of my research on this book, Carl Blagan, the director of the Troy excavations, who had been very high up in the Foreign Nationalities branch of OSS in Washington at this time, he was recruited to be the cultural attaché in Athens after the war. And another archaeologist followed him. And while they were involved with the American embassy in Athens, they were also on part of an organization called the American Mission for Observing Greek Elections, AMFOG. And the archaeologist working with Carl Blagan, Alison France from Princeton, went to Smith. She wrote home that it was just a sham. It was a complete sham.
The election.
The result was predetermined. The king came back.
He did for a time. Well, it's been a fascinating, if rapid, look at Greece at a time when there was a lot going on, a very dangerous time for archaeologists to be spies. World War II, they were working for the OSS, the forerunner of the CIA in Greece during World War II, and we've heard just a little bit about it from the author of the book, Classical Spies, American Archaeologists with the OSS in World War II Greece. She's Susan Hoik Allen, and a pleasure to meet you and hear some of these stories.
Thanks so much, Norman. It's my pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.